Hello, Blog Talk Radio. Hello, everybody out there in Blog Talk Radio land. My name is Dave Weiner, and I'm here with Jay Rosen. Jay?
Hi, Dave, and hello, listeners.
Hello, and I want to explain up front that the reason I sound so crappy today is that I'm coming to you via Skype, via Blog Talk Radio, and we're not in the studio today. And that's because our beloved engineer, Adrian, is on vacation. I think he's in Africa or Asia or Antarctica or somewhere very exotic, hopefully enjoying himself. And hopefully next week we'll be back in the studio.
So we're doing it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, it might even work. So what's up, Jay? What's the first thing on our list for this week?
Well, there was a development this morning that triggered a post already at Scripting News that I wanted you to summarize for listeners. As you wrote, there's news this morning of an end-user app development tool from Google. So
I'd like you to summarize it. Why don't you summarize it first? I'd be interested to hear
what it says to you, what you hear about. Well, my summary of it is that Google has come out with an application that allows virtually anyone who's not even a programmer to create mobile apps for its Android system, and they've made it super simple to do so, and they've been testing it, and they're almost ready to go live with it, and that was the news that emerged today.
Cool. And so what's your expectation from this, I guess, the question? Because, it doesn't have to be yours. I mean, you could quote Jeff Jarvis if you want.
I don't know what's going to happen. I think it's an interesting development. I would never make a prediction about it because I generally don't do that. I'm more cautious than that.
Very cautious there, Jay.
Yeah, I'm very cautious.
You don't want to get caught making a prediction here. That would be bad.
No, I don't. But I think it's very interesting. And I read your post and I read Jeff's post and I have a bone to pick with you.
I figured you did. That's why I wanted you to go first. And the bone is?
The bone is you say that you're from Missouri and you need to be shown, and I'm totally down with that, and that you're skeptical that this will be the big deal that people say, and you say that you've been through this idea of a once-and-for-all development tool that will allow us to say goodbye to programmers forever. And I'm just very skeptical that anyone has said that this is going to be goodbye to programmers forever, and there wasn't anything in your post about that. So who's saying that? What?
Oh, there are people who are saying it. I mean, that
really?
Was what I was trying to. Yeah. I read
Where?
A bunch of articles. Go to TechMeme, and, you'll see them. They're there. I mean, Jeff Jarvis more or less said that too.
No, he didn't.
Sure he did. And
that this is the end of programmers?
No, he said this is he kind of did. He said the priesthood would go away, or maybe this would be. I mean, he qualified it. I mean, there was a lot of people saying, and they say it all the time, every time this comes up. And, when I said to Jeff offline in the email thread, nothing would please me more if it would knock the knees out from under the priesthood. I mean, I would be very happy to see that happen.
I get that, yeah.
It's cut the productivity of my career a lot, probably much more, directly than it has anybody,
Here's what I don't get, Dave. In your post, there's a link to a Wikipedia entry for what a divining rod is, but there's no link to anyone saying that this is going to be a once-and-for-all development tool that will put programmers out of business. I mean,
I'll go get this. They're not there, I'll post an update to the piece saying, mea culpa, there were no pieces, I invented this out of thin air. I mean, if that's true, I will say that. I mean, I wrote a piece this week saying, what's so hard about a mea culpa in relationships? And I come from a world where basically, once I've been proven wrong, I'm going to say I was wrong and fix the goddamn bug and move on, right? I mean, I'm a little, I wrote a piece called, you know, "We're All Barking, Farting Chihuahuas." This is a few years back. And I don't think that it matters whether I'm wrong or right. You know, what matters is that, you know, I mean, everybody makes mistakes, right?
Okay, so why is this not a good development, or is it a good development? It's just not a
word. It probably is a good development. And it's the, as I say in the piece, it's not the problem, at least by the exact quote for you. I don't want to misquote myself here on the spot here. The problem is the sales pitch, not the software. You know.
Okay,
it's,
but
it's
that's why I want evidence of the sales pitch.
I hear you, and I should look right from the sales pitch, that term, to the actual sales pitch. I mean,
okay.
That's the problem. It's been going on. This goes back to, in my experience, and probably before it, although maybe not, to COBOL. COBOL is a very ancient programming language, and after that came, and they said basically, you just tell the computer what you want in English, and then it just does it for you. And the problem with that was is that when you actually see the English, you have to type to get the computer to do what you want it to do. It turns out it's programming. Then the same thing came up with HyperCard. HyperCard made the same claim. It said, oh, you just type English in the computer and it'll figure out what you mean and it'll do it for you. And that's the snake oil right there. I mean, it's this idea that you don't, and you said it yourself in your intro, that you don't have to be a programmer to write programs. And that's the silly thing, because you do have to be a programmer to write programs. It's like saying you don't have to be a skier to ski. Well, but you do. I mean, I'm a skier. I think you are too, right? And I've never been able to go skiing without avoiding the long trip in the car to the ski mountain and then the expense of staying in the hotel and having to get all the equipment and then waiting in the lift line and riding up on the lift and, oh, my God, it's cold. And then the snow sucks. And, you know,
I thought what I said was you don't have to be a programmer to use this tool.
Well, and in fact, it's a programming tool. So in case that is what you said is, I mean, it is a programming tool. It's more like Visual Basic than anything. That's what it turns out. It's like Visual Basic.
All right.
It is a programming language and a programming tool. And it's got some nice concepts that make it easier to learn how to program, but you are still learning how to program.
Okay. Well, I want to see who said that we won't need programmers anymore.
Yes, I know.
I'm extremely skeptical of that. Extremely.
Jay Rosen, you should have like a template for this because we could write a script that would be Jay Rosen.
Oh, I know.
Okay, this is your template. I'm getting to know you. And like I said, I will retract if I can't find.
Okay. Meanwhile, if we pull the camera back a little bit from this one announcement today, something I've been thinking a lot about is that we see this this choice of direction occurring again and again, where one player is betting on more openness, more participation, being available to more people. And another player, equally powerful, is placing more and more bets on a gated system or controls or limited access. So you see it in news with the Guardian's direction, which is full on in the open philosophy. And where Murdoch is going, which is increasingly gated and controlled and for paying customers only under the name of, under the sign of quality, right? And while it's easy to portray these two things as kind of a duel to the death or a war between them, maybe they'll just go forward together and one won't actually be able to triumph over the other. One won't be strong enough to triumph over the other, as it seems to me at least possible. But I think we are seeing this pop up again and again, these two different directions as people try to come to grips with the rebooted system, not just in news, but in media and media hacking generally.
Yep, that sounds about right. I mean, Google's approach, we like that one better, right? I mean, we just...
Well, I am myself more positive to the open approach, but I recognize that there are problems generated by the open approach that cannot be solved within that approach. And so that's the opening for the more gated players to do their thing.
I'm not entirely sure that that's true. I don't know what's a good example of what
I don't know if it's true either, but that's my current hypothesis. It may not prove to be true. But we'll see. I mean, can openness solve the problems of openness is the question. Maybe it can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the case of Android, the problem is which Android are you talking about? You know, that would be the example of, you know, Unix versus the other extreme, which would have been the Macintosh. Yeah, there are a lot of Unixes, but there's only one Macintosh. So it was easier to make software for the Macintosh because you only had to target one platform.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, if you wanted to make a new piece of hardware out of, you know, Unix, you could do it, but you couldn't do it with the Mac. I mean, that was they had an exclusive on it. Therefore, there were certain things that couldn't happen with the Mac as a result. And it's much worse, of course, with the iPhone and iPad and so forth. But, you know, you're kind of stuck if you can't get past Apple's sensors. And you don't really know what there's no method for that. They could change it in any moment. They could change their mind about what is an acceptable use of their platform. And they could even do it retroactively, you know. Then how do you know that, you know, how you could use it, because they have to change the moving target.
Well,
I ultimately do not think that's going to play out. I don't think it's going to work. I think that's a really fraught problem. It's got a cap on its growth because the government won't let it proceed. I mean, it once it gets to a certain point where it's achieved a certain level of market position, and it's going to get broken up. They can't let that go forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's practically un-American,
mm-hmm.
in my whole opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I can't prove it.
Right. Well, what
I
see
is...
It was
kind of a joke, actually. Never mind.
Right. So what interests me about this, and I think I've explained this before on Rebooting the News, is... that there's two directions in news that correspond to these two approaches. One is to try and address the producer class with a manufactured good news that is expensive and helps them be even better at producing and basically running the world. And that approach has always been disrupted and is threatened in a way by another, which is to open up news to the widest possible public, make it inexpensive and easy to access, and survive, sustain yourself by the much wider influence and power that comes from addressing the world, as it were. And these are two very different directions that news producers can go in. One is addressing essentially the elite and charging for it, and the end result is a better informed elite. And the other is engaging the broad public and trying to sustain yourself through the influence and power that the breadth gives you. And the end result, one hopes, is a more informed public. And I think that's a big choice that our journalists have to make. And if they see their future as bright only within the elite model, that's going to be a huge loss for them, because then we're going to need new players to come in, and we're going to need to keep the idea of news for the big public alive in some other way. So if they make that choice, it's too bad for them, but we're going to have to go on without them.
Maybe science blogs is a good model for that.
Yeah.
Pushing over to that one. I think that might be a good thing to talk about next. I mean, there was a big, some kind of a disruption, some scale of disruption over there in scienceblogs.com last week.
Let me give a summary of it.
Good idea.
For listeners. Science Blogs is a community of science writers, scientists who write, and science bloggers that was started by Seed Magazine and has come to be much larger than Seed Magazine. And it was a pretty vibrant community that included a lot of very talented people, some of whom are journalists, some of whom are not employed as journalists, but they write about science, and some of whom are working scientists. The community was kind of rocked by decision by the managers of the site to provide Pepsi Company with a blog at Science Blogs where Pepsi scientists could address issues that they say they're working on in nutrition and better ways to provide food to the world. And in the way that they configured this, Pepsi, of course, would pay for the privilege of having this blog at Science Blog. And in that sense, it would be a sponsored page. But the blog they gave Pepsi looked exactly like the blogs of the science writers and scientists at Science Blogs. And in fact, would be incorporated into the same system so that, for example, whatever rank in Google or prominence in Google News that Science Blogs had achieved through the quality of the service over the years would accrue to every post that the Pepsi scientists, who obviously are paid operatives of the company, would publish. And so as soon as the writers and bloggers at Science Blogs found out about this arrangement, they started to question it, and some immediately thought, this is very contrary to why I have signed up for this service. And a user revolt unfolded. At first, in very predictable fashion, the manager said, we stand by our decision, and here's why we're doing it, and we think it's fine, and no, we're not going to change our minds. And then as more writers began to both protest and pack up and leave by either setting up their own blogs or going to perhaps another community, and as more prominent contributors just decided this was serious enough to quit, the pressure built. And in somewhat predictable fashion, they decided to reverse themselves, and they eventually kicked Science. They kicked Pepsi Co. off and decided to end the experiment. And that's where it stands now. So that's an episode worth deliberating about and deciphering. And that's what happened.
Yeah, sources go direct, isn't it? I mean, it's about as good an example of that as you can find. I mean, these are all people who are presumably, or many of them at least, very knowledgeable about the subject that they're writing about. And they're also, you know, motivated enough to actually blog about it. And what a nightmare that, you know, a corporation that, I mean, there probably are corporations that wouldn't have been so controversial. Maybe Consumer Reports, maybe a nonprofit, for example, might not have been considered, you know, they might have had a place there, you know.
Right.
But PepsiCo is almost the anti-science. They're kind of like the tobacco industry. I mean, it could have been worse if the tobacco industry had been given a spot there, or maybe, like, probably the worst case would be if British Petroleum, BP, had been given a spot there.
Right.
It's pretty close to as bad as one person read that a friend of theirs said that as long as PepsiCo is getting some of the flow, they can't point to them on science blogs anymore. So it's a, you know, I don't know what else there is to say other than I believe, you know, having heard about this, that there's a need for a non-peer or a educational institution perhaps to step in and say, okay, let's provide the basic umbrella that something like this needs so that it can be pretty much free from this kind of interference that goes forward. Because the cost of operating one of these things is really negligible. It's not a very high cost thing to set up
right.
a blog server for, you know, a couple hundred blogs. And, you know, even if it's getting a lot of flow, it's not a big deal. And there's no reason that it has to ever go through this kind of controversy. When they're creating so much value, you know, they're certainly creating enough dollar value, even with very little advertising on it, to pay for itself.
And I don't understand how the managers of the system didn't see this as a problem from the beginning. I mean, it's a little bit hard for me to grasp how they could overlook the possibility of a user revolt.
I think they've had user revolts before. I don't think this is a new thing for them. And, you know, it's always hard to gauge the magnitude of something like that. I mean, the guy who wrote the article, The Runaway General, in Rolling Stone, I think, I forget the title, but he didn't think it was going to end in McChrystal getting fired. He just thought, okay, there would be a, you know, somewhat kind of, so they often mistake these things, and mm-hmm. and it's also a sign of desperation. Maybe they had, I don't think they had a choice. I think that basically they operate this, because they're also trying to keep their magazine alive.
Right, yeah.
And as I think that it appears from the outside that Science Blogs is the cash cow here, and you know the cash drain is seen, and so it needs money, and this is where they're getting money from.
Three things struck me about this. One is, and we've seen this before online, is there's a very tricky problem when you try to introduce changes to a system where the users can employ that system to organize and protest the changes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've been on the other side of that one. I mean, I absolutely understand that one. I mean,
yeah.
I've also been in a situation where I've had a business that was on the ropes and needed the cash, where you have to do things that, you know, where you have to make that kind of a change, where you have
yeah.
to change the terms of the deal. And absolutely, if the users have blogs and that's what you're providing them with, you got a serious problem right there.
Yeah. So that was one thing. A second thing was, you know, initially you think, well, why didn't they just set Pepsi's blog off from the others, make it a distinct space, make it
clear?
Well,
I know the answer to that. Come on, Jay. That's obvious why they didn't do that. I mean,
okay,
I
why?
Mean, okay, good. All right, thank you. This is the final Jeopardy answer. I think I win. Hey, multimedia. I run conferences, right? And the sponsors want to have it appear as if they're speakers, right? And I
right.
say, well, what about if I tell them that you paid for this, you know, and if you do it at lunch instead of with all the other guys? Oh, no. Do that. It has to look like you chose us. So that's why. Because Pepsi never would have gone for it. That wasn't what Pepsi bought. Pepsi wanted it to appear as if they were being scientific.
Yeah.
And it right? So
yes.
If it were set apart, it wouldn't have that aura of being scientific. They wanted to buy the authority or cash in, sell out the authority, because after they do this, it won't have the authority anymore, right?
Yes, that was the answer I was going to give, but you gave it instead.
Oh,
so that
sorry.
That's perfect. That's the way it should work. What was the third thing? the third thing was that not only do the users of science blogs have the ability by using science blogs and the fact that they read each other's sites, right, to organize over the same system that they're protesting, but they're so well linked to the rest of the media world, like through Twitter and Facebook, and the fact that many of them are read by journalists who report for, let's say, The Guardian or The New York Times, that the distance between an internal controversy over the running of the system and the worldwide media system is really small. And so it can go from an internal dispute to a major news story, you know, overnight.
Yep.
And we've seen that before, but it was a particularly striking example of it and of the new balance of power that exists between the users of these user-driven systems and the managers of it. It's not really clear who has the power, as I think you know from running such systems and being part of them. I think that's interesting.
Right. Well, it's a perfect segue to two different things that we want to talk about today. One is, we'll come back to this in a second, is the fire in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, talking about how the new system works. And the other thing is I want to just briefly come back to a video quote from today's New York Times article. The goal is to enable people to become creators, not just consumers, in this mobile world, said Harold Abelson, computer scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who's on sabbatical at Google and led the project. So there's your snake oil right there.
Well, why is that snake oil? He says the goal is to make people become creators.
Sounds great. Right. Right. Well, but that's right.
So what's the
snake
oil?
What's the snake oil? Well, the snake oil is that the statement is, sounds like a very innocuous statement, doesn't it? But the problem is it's not qualified. It's a very small number of people to become creators, not consumers. Because we have prior art here. There was Visual Basic, which is what this is like. And, you know, how many people that use Windows were actually able to use Visual Basic to make applications? In other words, the promise here that he's making is far, far broader than he can deliver.
Well, I don't know. I see a big difference between this will enable people to become creators, not just consumers, and everybody's going to be a programmer now, and we don't need programmers anymore.
Okay,
Yes, you did.
All right. Okay, we'll come back to it again. All right.
Okay.
It's good. This is interactive, right? It's a real time.
Yes.
I actually do think that's a good enough quote. So I happen to be hanging out on Twitter. I'll get to the day last week. And I was looking out my window. I'm in the West Village. And my window looks, I guess it's southeast window. And I first thought, I thought it had stopped raining. And it's because the sky was black. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so I get up and look, and it's not that there's rain clouds coming, because it had really come down hard earlier in the day. But there was a fire. And so I immediately got out my iPhone and started taking some pictures and uploaded them. And then looked in my tweet. This is on Thursday. And then looked in my tweet stream and saw that other people were uploading pictures from all kinds of different points of view. Some were east of the fire. Some were south of the fire. And then one came up that was across the street from the fire and above it.
I saw that. That was unbelievable. Yeah.
That was the killer picture right there.
Yeah,
but
that
all
was
this
the killer
happened,
picture.
Yeah, all this happened in the space of like 5 minutes. Five minutes from looking out my window, seeing the smoke, and to knowing exactly where it was, Houston Avenue A, or I'm actually, I don't remember, but
I think it was First Avenue in Houston.
Yeah, and then there was video and all the rest of this. We had the complete story, and if you think about it, what was in the old days the story? How would they have covered this? Well, a Daily News or New York Post or New York Times reporter, how would they get there? They would take a cab, I guess. Huh? How would they get there? What do you think?
How would they report the story, you mean?
Well, physically, yes. How would they do that? How would they actually get a reporter there, and how long would it take?
Well, they would do two things. They would certainly send somebody there, and by any means necessary. So it's up to the reporter to figure out how to get there as soon as possible. If the fastest thing is to take a cab, you take a cab. If you can do it by subway, you do that. And then they would have somebody in the office working phones and calling the sources, especially in the fire department, who would be able to tell them what went on. And so this is one thing I wanted to ask you. You said that after 15 minutes or so, we had a complete story. Did we know how the fire started? Did we know who owned the building? Did we know what this fire was caused by?
Well, we did not know all of that. And,
all right.
We did know some of it, though. We did know where the building was, and we did know what businesses were. We didn't know what businesses were in the building.
Right.
And the ownership, if anybody cared, I'm pretty sure we could have known it. I guess the other question is, would we have known it otherwise? In other words, would this have risen to the height of a story? Would this have appeared in the newspaper with all that information? I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, it might not. It depends on how big and how much damage, of course.
I think that today's news industry would very likely just have given us a picture.
Yeah. Local journalism, or what's sometimes called hyper-local journalism, and I think it's hysterical that people go crazy over the name. This is another thing that I think is really funny. But anyway, this is the level of local journalism that had been neglected for a lot of times. People would see things happening in their world. They wouldn't know exactly what they were, like, what's that smoke in the horizon, right? The news would be too small for the metropolitan news agencies that are really covering the region to care about. But people on the streets who are near these events care a lot about them, right?
And you would never find out. Right?
And you'd never find out, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where the news system is so much more effective.
It happened last night. I was rushing to get out to go to a movie with a friend and come down the elevator, and my God, there's like five cops in the lobby of my apartment building, you know? And one of the tenants is standing there screaming at the cops, right? And I have to rush through this situation. And, you know, because I have to get somewhere, right? And so I do, and come back. Now there's another, you know, nobody that was there then is there now. And no idea. And of course, that kind of event happens in New York every 5 minutes, right?
Right.
So what are the chances of finding out? No. By the time it makes it back into the lobby, it's going to have been distorted 50,000.
Exactly. Right. And that's why I developed my definition of citizen journalism, which I believe is the correct definition. It goes like this. When the people, formerly known as the audience, use the tools they have to inform one another, that's citizen journalism.
Why? Can I ask you a question? Since you are like taking a stake in the term citizen journalism, why citizen? I mean, this is something that always bothered me. I mean, the professionals aren't citizens. What is this? I mean,
again, I think this is so hilarious. This fetishism about the terms. It doesn't matter to me what we call it that much. I don't have an investment.
Can we come up with a better way of
But if we say just journalism, it's just journalism, which is what people are always telling me, then we don't have any way of designating that this way of getting news is in fact different than waiting around for a professional news organization to decide that the fire on First Avenue and Houston Street rises to the level of interest for the entire region. So there's something different about a peer-to-peer pattern in news production when compared to the sort of center margin structure of a professional news organization. So what is the right term for that system? Citizen journalism seems fine to me, but it doesn't really matter if that's the right term as long as people understand what's different about that concept.
Okay, I often will say exactly the same thing. I still don't like it, but I'm willing to accept it from that standpoint. Can we move on?
Yeah.
Good. Let's talk about torture and waterboarding, because I understand, well, this was a big story and continues to be a big story. There was a study at Shorenstein at Harvard Kennedy School, and what they found was that when the United States wasn't doing waterboarding, they studied four newspapers, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, USA Today, and the LA Times, and they found that when the United States wasn't doing it, they would generally characterize it as torture, and once the United States started doing it, they would generally not characterize it as torture. And I thought it was, very quickly a wonderfully interesting thing to study, because it probably indicates that there are 50,000 other things like it. But to pick one and just go so deep on it, it's very, very useful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
What do you think?
Well, I think I was responsible for getting that story into the media and across Twitter. It was a Twitter sensation, because somebody who's been sending me stuff for a long time, for years, who just occasionally just sends me articles and studies over email, sent me a link to this and said, I think you'd be interested in it. And it had actually been online since April, this study, but I don't think anyone noticed it.
It has been online since April, that's right.
Yeah. And I looked at it, and it said not just what you summarized well, but the numbers were striking. They had counted references to waterboarding as torture since the 1930s. And up through 2000, the Times called it torture like 84% of the time. And after 2002 to 2008, 1.4% of the time. So I took that statistic, which is in the report, and I made my Twitter post just out of that, with, of course, a link to the PDF of the study. And then close to more powerfully than anything I've done over Twitter, it went viral. Not just across that network, but into the press itself. And eventually the Times wrote a story about it by Brian Stelter, who is probably their most Twitter-connected reporter.
Yeah.
And Bill Keller was asked to address it. And
that was – tell us what he said.
Well, then it was amazing – what he said, and although I wasn't totally surprised because he said things like this before, but he said, well, maybe we didn't use the politically correct term, but in describing this practice, our readers were never in any doubt about how brutal it was and how controversial it was, because even though we didn't use the term torture, which he said was the politically correct term, we still made it clear that this was a brutal practice. And that idea that what people who were astonished by this study or outraged by it or just upset that the Times would back off on the word torture like that when it's clearly not done so before, the idea that that's the politically correct term and enhanced interrogation techniques, or harsh interrogation methods is sort of the the more straightforward term, was so backwards and so bizarre in its reasoning that it just seemed kind of amazing in a way. That, and Keller went on to explain, and this intersects with a lot of work that I've been doing, a lot of writing I've been doing lately, that when there is a dispute about a term, we try not to take sides. And, of course, you can understand where that's coming from. That's the standard view of objectivity in journalism, or as I call it, the view from nowhere. But what Keller seemed to be totally unaware of is that that leaves the Times vulnerable to bad actors who can create disputes about terms simply for the purpose of making it impossible for the mainstream press to call a spade, or to call an axe, you know, or to call choking, choking. And that's how he got work, because he wasn't aware of that possibility of actors creating disputes around terms that are actually quite settled, that he had worked himself into this really weird position. And one more thing on this, Dave, there's actually a term for this kind of behavior. It's called the Overton window, which I've written about before at my blog, O-V-E-R-T-O-N. You can find an entry on it in Wikipedia. And the Overton window is a concept developed by a political scientist to explain how people how people extend the sphere of the legitimate subject to talk about or argue about by being so extreme in their claim, by claiming something so fantastic that that extreme claim may be rejected, but the whole consensus frame moves a little bit towards their direction. Right? So by saying that there's no evidence that the Earth is warming at all, it's all been made up, right? You hope not to get that claim accepted, but simply to introduce some doubt about something.
So now they say that the theory that the world is warming up is controversial.
Exactly. That's the Overton window, right? And
I'd like to, we only have 2 minutes left. I'd like to just briefly mention something in the time that we have left about the technical aspects of the podcast, and ask people to let us know if they're having problems with the enclosures, with getting the MP3s from our podcast. There's some kind of a glitch. We use WordPress.com to host rebootnews.com, and their process for including a podcast in a blog post or an RSS enclosure, which is what a podcast is to basically paste in the URL of the MP3, and then it will scrape the text of the post, and when it sees an MP3, it'll read it. It'll determine that it's something that could be a podcast, and will then add an enclosure to the feed. The problem has been this, is that the post often appears in the feed without the enclosure, and then maybe 5-10 minutes later, the enclosure shows up. The problem is that a lot of people read the feed before the enclosure is there and say, okay, well, I've already seen it. This post, no need to read it again. And which is, by the way, the way the feed readers are supposed to be taken, and never actually get the enclosure. So I just got an email from Joseph Scott at WordPress, and he says that they believe that this time when we do it, when we publish it, that actually everybody will get the enclosure. So I don't know how to put it, but if you don't get the enclosure, let us know. It's one of those things is if you didn't get this phone call, then call us back. You know, it's kind of hard to say what they should do exactly, but there's been a problem in the last 4 podcasts that many people have not gotten them. I haven't gotten them, for example.
If you have any self-reports that would help us with this, let us know.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good way to put it. Right on. So we didn't get to everything this week, but we did cover a lot.
But that's all right. we're back on track.
Right. Thanks, Jay. Have a great week. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care, Dave. Bye.